Of Amos this morning, and Amos and Obadiah, and I think what we'll do is we'll cover Amos this morning, and then if everyone's all right with it, this afternoon I'll take about 10 or 15 minutes and we'll look at Obadiah this afternoon shortly. I just feel like since we have that opportunity, we probably better take it because it answers the question for us. And it tells us a little bit more about Amos the man.
Then Amos answered and said to Amasa, I was no prophet, nor was I a son of a prophet, but I was a sheep breeder, a tender of sycamore fruit. And the Lord took me as I followed the flock, and the Lord said to me, go prophesy to my people Israel. Now therefore, hear the word of the Lord. You say, do not prophesy against Israel, and do not spout against the house of Isaac.
All right. So now we've learned some more about Amos. What else do we know about Amos? So he wasn't just hanging out with the sheep breeders. He was a sheep breeder himself. And it also appears like he's a shepherd. And I think that makes sense that if you're a man who breeds sheep, you also are a shepherd because it says he was following the flocks. But what else do we know about Amos? Yeah. I've seen a lot of sycamore trees, and I'm pretty sure that that fruit on a sycamore tree, the thing that turns into the spike balls, right? Isn't that, no, it's a sweet gum tree. That's the sycamore is the one that blows up in your hand, right? Either way, I'm not eating a sycamore fruit. I'm like, I don't see what this is. So it's actually a wild fig is what this is. So it's a variety of fig. So, all right, so he took care of sheep, took care of wild figs. What else do we know about him?
He's not in the heritage of prophecy. He wasn't a prophet, and his father wasn't a prophet.
Okay, so all right, so let's start with the first thing. He wasn't a prophet, right? Which is interesting because he is a prophet. But the point that he's making to this other man, Amaziah, is that he was not a prophet when he was called. But then he says something else. He says he was not a son of a prophet. So now, James, I'm gonna disagree with you. Because when he says I'm not the son of a prophet, I don't think he means that his father was a prophet. And the reason I think that is Amos was contemporary with, well, he was shortly after Elisha. And in 2 Kings chapter 2, it's the story of Elijah and Elisha as they're traveling across the Jericho for Elijah to go up in the whirlwind. So there in chapter 2, the first couple of verses, remember that Elisha meets up with some people. You know what? Let's just read. Somebody read 2 Kings 2 and verse 3.
Now the sons of the prophets who were in Bethel came to Elisha and said to him, do you want that the Lord will take away your master from over you today? And he said, yes, I know. Keep silent.
All right. So they go to Bethel, and at Bethel, they meet up with this group of people who are called the sons of the prophets, and then they go a little bit further, and they get to Jericho, and they meet up with this group of people who are also called sons of prophets. You skip ahead to chapter 4, and it's Elisha, and he meets up with 50 men who, again, bear this same name, sons of the prophets, who he put some flour in a pot and helps the stew to be good. It appears to me, and I could be wrong here, that there was this group of people who are mentioned during this time of Elisha. And Elisha was about 850 to 780. Now Amos prophesied shortly after. But it appears to me that this is a group of people who either studied with or served the prophets. I don't think when Amos is saying son of a prophet, I don't think he means his father was a prophet. I think he means that he's not part of this group that hung out with the prophets. He had this other job. He was a sheep breeder and a tender. I think that becomes important because what we'll see about Amos here in a couple of minutes. But okay, any other comments there? There was one other thing about Amos that we didn't mention. Where was he from? Tekoa. Okay. It's not like a super prominent town, but if you were to happen to look up Tekoa, what would you find out about it?
It was in Judah,
yeah.
And he's prophesying in Israel.
Yeah, so we're going to get to that in just a second, but it's important to talk about now. He prophesies in Israel, and yet he's from Tekoa. He's from Judah, and this may have been it's either a city of Benjamin or a city of Judah. I can't quite figure it out. It's 12 miles south of Jerusalem, all right? So, the overall picture of Amos is really interesting because you get this picture that Amos is, we might call him just a country bumpkin. He's just a simple old sheep breeder. And it sort of sounds like maybe he's not even all that well-to-do, that he's just a sheep breeder who has some side jobs of taking care of the herd, and he's not even from the nation of Israel. And then, when you start looking at the message of Amos, Amos's message is super blunt, and it's sometimes viewed as being very negative. We might describe Amos's messages as a message of hell, fire, and brimstone, right? That's the kind of message that Amos had. So, you have this picture of Amos in your mind. So, where is Amos? Maverick already told us, Amos is... message is to Israel, but is it exclusively to Israel?
No.
It's not. It's not. And we'll get to that in just a moment. But all right, so Amos is from Judah. He's giving this message to Israel. And did the people of Israel like it? No, not at all. In fact, Amos basically gets kicked out. And we'll talk about that here shortly, too. Yeah?
About the sons of the prophets and all that. Israel, it got so wicked, most of the true prophets were running to Judah. And they kind of went into a colony there. But then the sons of the prophets, I think, are those who wanted to be or whatever. But I don't think Amos was part, he wasn't part of that group.
No, So, to your point, I think this is 1 Kings 12. Is that right? No. Well, I'm not going to know the passage right off the top of my head. But you remember that one of the kings of Israel was wanting to go into battle against the Assyrians. And he asked for a prophet. And there weren't any prophets left except for the one guy, Micaiah, something like that. Sounds like a good name, Sheila, just in case, you know. He was the only one left because all the rest of them had left. And that king hated that prophet because he always gave bad news to the king of Israel. So you're right. They pretty much all left. Okay. So even though the recipient is Israel, Amos prophesied about several other nations. That's really chapter 1 and the first part of chapter 2. He prophesies to Damascus, which is the city of Syria, Gaza, which is the Philistines, Tyre, which is the Phoenicians, Edom, Ammon, Moab, and then Judah. Okay, so why would Amos, in his message to Israel, start with prophesying about all of these other nations?
It kind of interested the people because they were interested in hearing about their enemies.
That's exactly right. And so it's almost like Amos uses this to get their attention. Because chapter 1 through chapter 6 is one, it appears to me it's one continuous prophecy that happens at Bethel. We'll get to that, but it seems like Amos uses this to kind of get their attention, And the people would have liked to hear this, right? They would have really liked to hear what's happened to all these nations who have been a thorn in their flesh for a long time. And even about rival Judah. Oh, Judah's going to be punished. So you can imagine that they're really liking the message of Amos. But then in chapter 2, he turns the tables and then starts prophesying about Israel. He sort of drops the real message on the people of Israel.
Oh.
Oh, no.
Yeah. So first, he's just given him the word.
Yeah. He's beating them with the... Beating them, isn't he? You're right. Yeah. So really, the book is broken down into really two sections, right? It's chapter 1 through 6, which is this one prophecy of Israel. And then chapter 7 through 9 are some visions that he has. So this is actually the first... book that we've got, that we've studied, that has some visions like this in it. But all right, let's get back to the next question. When is the book written? Or when did Amos prophesy? Well, unlike the other books, we've got a really clear picture of when this happens. So who were the kings during the time of Amos?
Uzziah was in Judah,
and who was the king in Israel?
Jeroboam
II, right, yeah. And we got to specify because there were two Jeroboams. So this is the second Jeroboam. Now, Uzziah and Jeroboam's reign overlapped by 15 years. So this is written sometime between 767 and 753 B.C. But if that's all the information we had, we'd know there was a 15-year gap. But we're told one other thing. What's the other thing we're told about this book? Yeah, 2 years before the earthquake. And Eric, you qualify it as major, and I think you're right, because earthquakes would have been a common thing, or were a common thing in Israel. They're very common today. Already in 2019, Israel has experienced 6 earthquakes of 2.0 or greater. You know, you think about that. I mean, it's the 20th of the month, and they've already had 6 earthquakes. So there were earthquakes were somewhat common, but it seems to me that there was something special about this earthquake that would have made it memorable for the people. And this same event is also referenced in Zechariah 14 and 5. Here in Zechariah 14 and 5, Zechariah, which prophesied a long time after Amos, says, "Then you shall flee through my mountain valley, for the mountain valley shall reach to Azel. Yes, you shall flee from the earthquake. You shall flee as you fled from the earthquake in the days of Uzziah, king of Judah." So during this time of Uzziah, there was an earthquake that the people ran away from. And so archaeological evidence suggests that there was this massive earthquake that was estimated to be 7.8 and 8.2 on the Richter scale. I don't know how you figure that out. It must be through what the image looked like. And it happened sometime between 760 and 750. So, hey, this is right in that same time frame, an earthquake that happened during the reign of Uzziah. Now, how big is a earthquake that's an 8.0 on the Richter scale? Well, you've heard about the New Madrid Fault, and there was an earthquake in 1811 and 1812 over there. That was that earthquake was estimated to be at a 7.9, so right in that sweet spot, 7.9 or 8 point something. But anyway, it's the one that made the Mississippi River flow backwards. So you can imagine that if in fact this earthquake that happened in the days of Uzziah was that big, of course it's going to be memorable. So I mean, we still talk about the New Madrid earthquake, and it's 200 years ago. So you can imagine the same thing happens. Now, Josephus equates this earthquake to two additional passages, one in Isaiah 6, where Isaiah is talking with God. In Isaiah 6 and 1, it says, "In the year that King Uzziah died..." And then in verse 4, it says, "The posts of the doors were shaken by the voice of him who cried out." Now, is this prophetic? I don't know. But Josephus seems to think that this was at the same time, and that this all occurred when Uzziah goes into the temple and tries to offer incense. That it was at that point in time that Uzziah gets leprosy. That's when this earthquake happened. That's what Josephus says. All right, so anyway, the point is the book is written around 750. What is the state of the nation of Israel during Amos's prophecy? Well, Jeroboam had recaptured all of the land. He had taken everything back that had once belonged to Israel, that had been taken by all these other nations. 2 Kings chapter 14:25 tells us that Jeroboam had done that. And in fact, it was the will of God that that had happened. It was very prosperous during this time. I think it's interesting that Jeroboam makes peace with all these other nations through conquest. And it was a peace that didn't exist since the time of Solomon. And with that peace came prosperity, and prosperity that also hadn't been seen in Israel from the time of Solomon. So there's peace, and there's prosperity, and lots of wealth. And as we read the book, you'll see that there's actually some condemnation associated with that wealth. And I want to read one passage that sort of describes how much prosperity there was. Someone read Amos 6, verses 3 through 7. And this is a woe that's being pronounced, but in it we get a picture of how prosperous Israel was. Amos 6, 3 through 7.
Woe to you who put far off the day of doom, who cause the seed of violence to come near, who lie on beds of ivory, stretch out on your couches, eat lambs from the flock and calves from the midst of the stall, who sing idly to the sound of stringed instruments and invent for yourselves musical instruments like David, who drink wine from bowls and anoint yourselves with the best ointments, but are not grieved for the affliction of Joseph. Therefore they shall now go captive as the first of the captives, and those who recline at banquets shall be removed.
So we get this picture that Israel was just living in the lap of luxury. And for what it's worth, as I was looking through the book of Amos, I sure couldn't help but make some connections to the kind of life that we generally live. That very well, you know, the message that Amos is given, I mean, I think there's probably a lot that could apply to us. All right, so what's the major theme of the book? I think Mike gave us a hint. It's a four-letter word. Doom. That's exactly right. I think that's the major theme of the book is doom. In fact, sometimes Amos is called the prophet of doom. But really, punishment is coming for sin. That's really the message. It starts with all the nations that wrong the children of Israel, that punishment is coming. Jeremiah says something similar in Jeremiah 12 and 14. Now, Jeremiah would have prophesied a little bit after Amos. But in 12 and 14, thus says the Lord, against all my evil neighbors who touch the inheritance which I have caused my people Israel to inherit, behold, I will pluck them out of their land and pluck out the house of Judah from among them. The children of Israel were given this land, and their surrounding neighbors took part of it. And it's because of that that God says, you're going to be punished. And now we could look at all of these nations. Let's just look at the first one. So the first one's Damascus in chapter 1, verses, was it 3 through 5 there? And Damascus, of course, is a capital city of the Syrians. And I think it's interesting that it starts with all of the judgments start this same way. For three transgressions of Damascus and for four, I will not turn away its punishment. What does that mean? Any thoughts on what that means? All of the prophecies of these other nations start the same way. Well, I think this is an expression of their sin. In other words, what I mean is that this isn't like a one-time occurrence. That this is happening over and over. That there's a consistency here. It's almost like saying, you know, you continue to do the same thing three times, four times. And so there's a repetitiveness in their sin. And so, as with Damascus, what is mentioned there in verse 5, the thing that's going to happen to them is that will cut off the inhabitants from the valley of Avon. It's really interesting that valley of Avon is mentioned. The Syrians, unlike the children of Israel, when they worshipped idols, where did they go? They went on high places, right? They went on mountains. The Syrians didn't do that. They worshipped in the valley. So this, I think, is probably a reference to their idolatry. The one who holds the scepter in Beth Eden, the people of Syria shall go captive to Kir. Very specific, going captive to Kir. If we went to 2 Kings 16, we'd see that the Assyrians take and help get the Syrian nation carried away captive, and specifically to this place called Kir. So very interesting. All right, so after going through all the nations and then going through Judah, then in chapter 2, verse 6 through 6 and 14 is this prophecy against Israel, and it exposes their sins. And what kind of sins had the children of Israel been partaking in that are specifically mentioned? That's right. So they oppress the poor. They sell the righteous into slavery. What other things? Their judges take bribes. That's 5 and 12. They're dishonest. Their sexual immorality is rampant. That's 2 and 7. They oppose the truth. They told the prophets of God not to preach. The people were obsessed with materialism. 4 and 1 talks about the women being obsessed with it, all of the people being obsessed. That's 3 and 15, and then 6 and the first few verses there. And their worship was corrupted, and that's sort of mentioned all throughout them. And really, the message was punishment's coming, and it's coming pretty quick. And actually, within about 30 years of the time of Amos's prophecy, those prophecies were fulfilled. So, what's interesting about Amos is that there's almost no mention of redemption. And most of the other major and minor prophets have some message of redemption or restoration. Amos devotes 5 verses in a 9-chapter book. Amos devotes the last 5 verses to talk about redemption and restoration. So Amos mostly ignores it. And why is that? Because Amos was this preacher of hellfire and brimstone, like, you better get ready because it's coming soon. And many of the people who were alive at the time of Amos's message would have been carried off into captivity. All right, so what about some key verses? Well, for me, one of the key verses is chapter 4, verse 12. I think chapter 4, verse 12 maybe sums up the message of Amos. Therefore, thus will I do to you, O Israel. Because I will do this to you, prepare to meet your God, O Israel. That was really what Amos was there to do, right? Amos was there to prepare them to meet God. But if there was maybe a section of passages that I think are really key, it's in chapter 5. So let's look at some of these in chapter 5. Let's start. Somebody read 14 through 15. All right. When I think about things in this book that maybe we can take application to, right? This is one of those, right? Just generally speaking, what should you do? You should seek good and not evil. You should hate evil and love good. If you can accomplish that in life, lots of the other things are going to work themselves out, aren't they? Now, let's skip ahead to verses 18 through 20. Somebody read that.
Will not the day of the Lord be darkness, not light, pitch dark, without a ray of brightness?
All right. Now, Remember that Amos is sort of writing very negative. And the day of the Lord is going to be both a wondrous day and a terrible day. Right? For most people, it's going to be a terrible day. But for those who are on the straight and narrow, it will be a wonderful day. But doesn't this happen a lot today where people, you know, they want the day of the Lord to come. You know, come Lord Jesus. They want the day to come. And yet, Amos warns the people here, and I think we can take a warning from it too, that don't desire the day of the Lord. Because it's like, I like these comparisons. It's like you got away from a lion just so you could get eaten by a bear. That's great, you know. Or I get this picture of a person who is running from danger and they make it to their home and they feel this sense of security and then they put their hand up on the wall and the snake bites them, you know. It sort of reminds me of some things that have said about this world, right? This world is either going to be the closest thing to heaven that people will ever be at, or it'll be the closest thing to hell that you'll ever be at. And so God says, woe to those people who are in Israel who are wanting the day of the Lord to come because you really don't know what you're asking for.
Well, then why?
Yeah.
Because they're not ready. Because
they're not ready. That's right. They're not ready. All right. The last thing out of chapter 5 that I really like is 21 through 24. Someone read that for us.
Nor will I regard your fattened peace offerings. Take away from me the noise of your songs, for I will not hear the melody of your stringed instruments. But let justice run down like water and righteousness like the mighty stream.
All right. This is really a message that we see a lot in the Old Testament that we could easily overlook. That now, the children of Israel, they were worshiping idols at this point in time, so their offerings weren't to God necessarily, but the point God's making here is all of this physical stuff, it just is making me sick because you're not doing it with the right things. You're not doing it with justice and you're not doing it with righteousness. That's what I want, justice and righteousness. Let's look at what the prophecies are. So we've kind of talked about the prophecies to the other nations, to Israel. Let's look at the visions while we have a couple of minutes. All right, so in chapter 7, verses 1 through 3, we have the first vision that Amos has, and it's locusts again. Man! So Amos sees this vision of locusts coming and eating all of the land. And it seems as though Amos intervenes and persuades God not to punish the people in this way. It's sort of the picture I get, that Amos sees this vision of the people being punished with locusts, and Amos persuades God to not punish them that way. Then he sees another vision, and a vision this time is of fire. And the same kind of thing happens. Amos prays that God doesn't make the people punished in this way, and so God doesn't punish them that way. And so then God shows Amos a plumb line. And I think this is really interesting, right? Because it's almost as if God is trying to show to Amos that it's time, that this people needs to be punished for their sin. Amos is saying, you know, please don't do this, please don't do this. And then finally God shows him a plumb line. And so what's the purpose of a plumb line? You builders out there.
Make something perfectly vertical.
Yeah, yeah. It's to get something straight, right? I've never used a plumb line. Dwayne, you used a plumb line? A lot. Mike used a plumb line. I've never used a plumb line.
Straight up and down,
right? And so it's interesting that God shows Amos, the Lord, standing on a wall with a plumb line. Now, who do you suppose that wall is supposed to represent? Israel, that's right. Now, in the writings of the priests of Israel, so not in the Bible, but in the writing of the priests of Israel, the priests call themselves, call Israel a wall. And so, it may be from this, I don't know, but Israel is certainly a wall. It's a wall that's already built. And if you put a plumb line on a wall that's already built, what are you going to see? Yeah, it's probably no longer plumb.
Let me just explain how we used it. Plumb line. You drive in a 16-penny nail at the top of the wall, tie your plumb bob, and let it hang down to just above the ground. And then you can measure out the top. Oh. If it's 2 inches, then it's got to be 2 inches at the bottom. So it's a measurement deal, too.
All right. Yeah, so you're using it to measure the wall. And so God here is using this to measure the children of Israel, the nation of Israel. And what does he find? He finds that
they're not true.
That's right. And that's the point of what he makes mention of here in verse 8. Behold, I am setting a plumb line in the midst of my people Israel. I will not pass by them anymore. He is no longer going to ignore the wickedness of the children of Israel. Now, right after this, something happens. This guy, Amaziah, complains. Now, Amaziah is a priest. He's a priest at Bethel. So is he a Levite priest?
No,
probably not. Right? Because what was at Bethel? It is where the calf was, right? Remember, the golden calves were at Bethel and Dan. So now, is the golden calf still there? I don't know. But it's always associated with idolatrous worship, right? So Amaziah complains, and he says, hey, this prophet Amos, the guy from Judah, he's saying things that the people don't like to hear. Now, what's interesting is what Amaziah says that Amos is saying. He says, Jeroboam will die by the sword, and Israel shall surely be led captive from their own land. Well, he basically says two things, gets one of them right and one of them wrong, right? The thing about being led away captive, yes, Amos was saying that. But did Amos say Jeroboam was going to die by the sword? No, he didn't. He said that Jeroboam's the house of Jeroboam would have a sword against it. Because when you look at, because I looked for a long time, I'm like, did Jeroboam die by the sword? I never saw that. Well, then I realized Amaziah was sort of twisting the words of Amos. So then Amos answers. And what's really interesting is, well, Amaziah says, get out of here, right? Verse 12, go back to Judah. We don't want you here ever again. And then in verse 14, Amos responds. And this is that passage we read in the very beginning. Amos is like saying, it's almost like Amos is saying, I don't want to be here either, right? God sent me here. I wasn't a prophet. I'm not the son of a prophet. I'm just a sheep breeder, and I tend to some figs. And God called me, and here I am. It's almost like Amos doesn't even want to be here either. But unlike Jonah, right, Amos goes when called. And so then, verse 17. So verse 17, Amos basically declares to Amaziah, you're going to complain about me? Well, here's what's going to happen to your family. We don't have any record of what happened, if this really happens, but I trust the Lord that this prophecy came true, that Amaziah's wife will be a harlot in the city, your sons and daughters will fall by the sword, and the land will be divided by a servant line. You shall die in a defiled land, and Israel shall surely be led away captive from his own land. All right. You're going to complain? Here you go. This is what really is going to happen to you. All right. So then there's, in chapter 8, there's this vision of a basket of fruit. And then in chapter 9, there is a vision of God standing by the altar. One thing in chapter 9 that's interesting. So chapter 9, verse 1. I saw the Lord standing by the altar, and he said, strike the doorpost that the threshold may shake. I don't know if this is when the earthquake takes place, or if this is another reference to the earthquake, but it sure seems like there's a connection there to be made. All right, two prophecies that I want to point out of interest, and then if we have time, we'll talk about some other things. But in chapter, when you think about the prophecies in Amos that we often reference, there's two of them. What's the one that comes to mind right away? Somebody read Amos 8 and 11, 11 and 12.
Behold, the days are coming, says the Lord God, that I will send a famine on the land. Not a famine of bread, nor a thirst for water, but of hearing the words of the Lord. They shall wander from sea to sea and from north to east. They shall run to and fro, seeking the word of the Lord, but shall not find it.
All right. Well, what's this a prophecy about? Yeah, there's going to be a time when God is just going to stop talking. And we know when that occurs, right? So at the end of Malachi, Malachi is the last prophet for about 400 years. And so this is that prophecy of that time when God is going to stop speaking through the prophets to the people. So there's one prophecy. Yeah.
Cut it off.
They're going to.
Now, that's not saying that some individuals out of the lost tribes of Israel didn't right themselves, but as far as those tribes, they were gone.
Never to be found again, really, yeah. And you're right. There are people who, and I don't have this, but there's people in the New Testament who we read about as being from some of the tribes, but it's never like what it was. They're mostly gone. Okay. The last prophecy is the positive prophecy, right? Let's look at Amos 9 and 11. On that day, I will rise up the tabernacle of David, which has fallen down, and rebuild it, its damages, and repair its damages, and raise up its ruins, and rebuild it as in the days of old, that they may possess the remnant of Edom, and all the Gentiles who are called by my name, says the Lord, who does this thing. So once again, we've got a minor prophet referencing that there will be a time when the Gentiles will be called by God's name. And we see this throughout the minor prophets. All right, other comments about Amos before we close? Okay.
Revealing only comes through the prophets from God.
That's right. All right, other comments here?
I want to say there in 7 and 13, where Amos 5 was chewing Amos out, he said, Bethel will stand for was the king's sanctuary, the royal residence. What he was doing is what we hear today. He was calling evil good and good evil. And today we're told by the society that we live in that we're evil because we don't embrace all kinds of sin. Well, Amaziah was a false prophet. The place he was leading false worship was not what God wanted. But yet he's telling the righteous servant of God, you're wrong.
Yeah. There's so much about this book that if you think about what our lives are like and what's going in our lives, man, the book of Amos is something that we can make a lot of comparisons to. All right, we'll take a short break. We'll look at Obadiah for a little bit this afternoon.